الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وبه نستعين، إنه خير ناصر ومعين. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. My respected elders and sisters and brothers in Islam and Iman, Salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'd like to begin tonight's speech by first of all acknowledging the great many of you who will inshallah be departing for ziyarah of Arba'een in the upcoming days. So many people have told me that they're going, that I made a suggestion to the ELC administration that why don't we make it an ELC express and move it to something that's on the go and we also go and join everyone else. But sadly, they didn't accept that proposition. Anyhow, I would like to, at least on my behalf, wish all of you who are going for ziyarah a very safe trip, a ziyarah which is accepted, inshallah. And I pray that you can, inshallah, take the most of this opportunity and benefit in all ways, both when it comes to attaining whatever needs that you have in your dunya and also even more importantly, in the hereafter. As a gift to those who will be going, I just want to share one story and then begin with the main portion of the speech. Basically, years ago, when I had first joined the Hauza, and I was getting ready to go for my first ziyarah of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam in Mashhad, I went to one of my good teachers, and may God bless him, I asked him, do you have any advice for me? Give me some advice. One of them is this story. He said, once upon a time there was a poet who was a great lover of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam. In particular, he had a special love for Amir al-Mu'mineen. And one day he goes to Najaf intending to perform the ziyarah of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he has a haja, he has a need that he wants to be fulfilled by the Imam alayhi salam. And as he goes to his beloved to perform the ziyarah, he's a poet, he's overcome by the moment and he starts to compose a line of poetry to express his sentiments at that moment. And this is what he's inspired to say. The Farsi is the following: Bezarre gar nazar lut. بزره گر نظر لطف کند بو تراب. Abu Turab is the name of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And a rough translation of this is the following, that if Imam Ali, Abu Turab, were to pay attention and to focus his special attention upon this zarra, this zarre, as they say in Farsi, zarra. Zarra is just a speck of dust. You know how when there's a ray of light that's shining into the room and you look at that ray of light, you can see tiny particles of dust that are floating there. This is called a dharra. If Abu Turab were to pay attention to this speck of dust, he himself sees himself as a speck of dust in front of Imam Ali alayhi salam, then didn't come to him. He couldn't figure out what to say. He's a poet, but for some reason he had just been inspired to do the if clause, the then clause didn't come to him. So he goes home at night, he's still in the proximity of the shrine, and in his dream, his beloved master, Imam Ali, comes to him. And he recites for him, بِزَّرِّقَرْ نَزَرِ لُطْفْ كُنَدْ بُوتُرَابْ. And then he completes it for him. What does he say? بِآسَمَانْ رَوَدْ وَكَارِ آفْتَابْ كُنَدْ. Which means the following, that if that one speck of dust were to be gazed upon, were to be given the special attention by Amir al-Mu'mineen, then it would ascend to the heavens and do the work of the sun. Meaning what? Meaning that after all, this sunlight right here is nothing but a byproduct of the sun itself. And it emanates and originates from the sun. We ourselves, in and of ourselves, we are nothing but specks of dust. But if we connected the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, who themselves are connected to Allah, that's when the potential is limitless. And these two lines have become something which is a bit of a sort of a parable or something, a very common phrase in the Persian language right now. And I pray that all of those who are going for ziyarah will remember us in your du'as as well too, and that you too inshallah can receive the special attention of all the a'imma alayhim as-salam, and that you too can come back shining that light of the sunshine for all of us. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Okay, it's a Monday night. The attendance is a little bit less naturally, but let's make up for it with the loudness of our salawats. One more time, please. Ahsantum, thank you. Hadith number 4. Our topic is we're looking at the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt having to do with living in environments in which we as Muslims are minorities. According to my count, until now we've covered 3 hadith. Hadith number 4 is the following. This is reported from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He says the following: one of you may say that he is gharib. One of you may say, he's talking to his companion, one of you may say that he is somebody who is gharib. Gharib means somebody who is far away from his homeland. He is a stranger. He is alone. He is distant from his home. Yet, Imam al-Islam clarifies, the true gharib, إِنَّمَا الْغَرِيبُ الَّذِي يَكُونُ فِي دَارِ الشِّرْكِ. The true gharib, the true person who is truly alone, is the one who resides and is present in the land of shirk. When I came across this hadith, I felt that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has shown me a jewel of a tradition. And what I'd like to do is to inshallah spend some time seeing if we can try to appreciate the beauty of this jewel and see how many lessons that we can get, practical lessons we can get that apply to our situation here, inspired by the guidance and the words of the Imam alayhi salam. First of all, just at a high level, when you hear Imam Sadiq alayhi salam speaking about one of his people, one of his Shias, residing in Darul Shirk, residing in the land of Shirk, how does that make you feel? Isn't it something special to know that our Imams alayhim salam had a special concern for people like us who are living as minorities in an environment in which most people don't believe in Allah and don't believe in the religion of Islam? That itself is one of the very important takeaways that we have from this hadith right here, that the Imam alayhi salam is speaking to our situation as well. This deen is something which is extremely relevant for our situation. Number one. Number two, that in the eyes of the Imam alayhi salam, we have a division of the world into two territories. One of them is Darul Iman, and the other one is Darul Shirk. The land of Iman and the land of Shirk. Now this again is something which is very important. That in the eyes of the Imam alayhi salam, it makes a difference whether or not Islam is practiced widely in the land that we're in. If it's not, then special care and concern has to be taken. Number three, that the Imam alayhi salam is referring to those who are living away from Darul Iman as being gharib, as being alone, as being distant from their home. And this is the point that we need to, inshallah, expand upon and see what does it mean to be gharib? And is it something positive? Is it something negative? What can we take from this? One thing I want to say right here and now, and make sure that there's no misconception in anybody's mind. The Imam alayhi salam is not telling us that, oh, you who live in Darul Shirk, leave and come to Darul Iman. He's not saying that. And that's not what Islam tells us either. He's acknowledging the role of Muslims who will live in Darul Shirk. And he's giving us some very important guidance as to how we should behave and how we should act when we're there. And this is the theme that we see reflected in many places in the body of traditions we have from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Let me give you another tradition, hadith number 5, for those who are keeping count. There was a man named Fudayk. Okay, Fudayk was somebody who was residing in Makkah. He was one of the people who converted to Islam in the early days, before the Hijrah. The Prophet performed the Hijrah to Medina from Makkah, and he commanded the Muslims to join him as well too. But according to some books of hadith, what we're told is that when Fudayk heard that he had to leave, he went to the Prophet, or he sent a message to the Prophet, and he says that, I am in Makkah, I cannot migrate. I have some reasons for why I cannot migrate. I need to stay with my family here. But the people, the Muslims, are telling me that if I don't migrate, then I'm going to come to ruin. Migration is necessary. I have to leave the land of Shirk, which is Makkah at that time, and I have to go to Medina, which is Darul Iman. To this, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi replies, he says, O Fudayk, establish prayer, avoid bad deeds, and live in the land of your people wherever you like. He's telling him that, Fudayk, it's not necessary for you to leave Darul Shirk. No, you can live there, but there are special considerations that you have to take into account. I have a special instruction for you now that you're here. So let's make this clear. That's not what the message of the Imam alayhi salam. He's telling us that if you're in this situation, then you are gharib. How are we going to understand this? I'm going to, inshallah, provide two takes on this hadith. This is coming from the basis of teachings of the Quran, hadith, and our respected scholars. Number one, the Imam alayhi salam is saying that one who is living in Darul Shirk is somebody who is gharib. Take number one is the following. That there is something about living in a land of shirk which contributes towards somebody's ghurbah, someone's aloneness. There's something about the environment of being among mushrikeen and among shirk that makes somebody alone. Now what is this being among people who are doing shirk with Allah that would make somebody alone? Think about it for a moment. If you go and look back at the history of our prophets, they all were raised among a people and they would tell their people, don't worship these idols. Why? Is it just the case that they didn't like the way the idols looked? They were just kind of a distraction in the way? Was it just the fact that people would spend a few days, a few minutes of their day, or a few, maybe up to an hour a day, worshipping the idols, and that's the only problem that they had with them? No, the idols that the people had throughout history were just symbols of a greater concept, which is this idea of living in a culture of shirk. And what the prophets were battling when they were battling the idols were the ideologies that came along with worshipping those idols. What we need to ask ourselves is, when it comes to our situation, what are the ideologies that we come in contact with by living in this land, which are opposed to the Islamic ideology, and which may cause somebody to lead a life of being alone and loneliness? One of these ideologies is something called materialism. And let me just give you the gist of what I want to try to convey, inshallah, prove and establish, is the following. That somebody who embraces materialism as an ideology will be somebody who's very lonely in their lives. What is materialism? Very simply, materialism is defined as the concept and the theory and the practice and the ideology of making our possessions be the goal for why we live and the source of all of our happiness. And somebody has put it very beautifully. He says that materialism is the worship of the material. It's the worship of those things that we can acquire and attain and have as part of our possessions. What we're saying is that materialism is something, number one, which is very prevalent in the societies that we live in. And this is something that I don't need to establish for you, because if you just look at the type of lifestyles that people typically will lead, Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Another salawat ala Muhammad. Thank you. This is something that I don't need to establish. Okay, the idea of making it big, of leading a big life, of wanting to get and get and get and consume and consume and consume and get and consume, and that cycle is something which is not hidden from any of us. But we have to understand what is the byproduct of falling into this cycle. And what I'd like to do tonight, inshallah, is to look at some of the guidance that we have from the Quran and the Ahadith about this matter. There's a difference in perspective of somebody who is a muwahid, somebody who is a Muslim, a practicing Muslim, and somebody who is a materialist. And the difference isn't something simple where we say that, you know what, you have to leave aside any type of desire to attain and to get and to make it big. No, that's not what Islam is saying on the situation at all. We need the material world to survive. We want that material world, and it's within us to want to attain it. But the approach that Islam takes is something which is a sophisticated approach to the matter. What Islam tells us is that when it comes to our acquiring possessions, they should never be acquired in and of themselves, that they are the goal, but rather they should be a means towards a greater goal, which is attaining felicity in the hereafter. And this simple point of having a goal behind why we do what we do when it comes to interacting with the physical world makes all the difference. I want to give you an example that illustrates this from the Quran. Nabi Sulaiman alayhi salam is tasked to spread the message of Tawheed across the lands. He is informed of a people who lead a life of materialism. They worship a God who is material. They pride themselves on possessions that are material. That's the limitation of what they know to be good and what they know to be true. He sends a message to them. Surah Naml. The message says the following, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم إنه من سليمان وإنه بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ألا تعلوا عليّ وأتوني مسلمين. This is from Sulaiman. It is with the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Do not defy me. Do not try to be superior to me. But rather come to me in submission. That's it. This is a sign of power. And this is a sign of a powerful believer who begins with the name of Allah. The queen of Sheba, as you know, she in hadith we're told that her name is Bilqis. When she receives this, look at the way that she understands this. Look at the limitations on her understanding. The conclusion that she comes up with is that, you know what? We're not going to submit to this man. We're going to deal with him the way we know how to deal with him. He's probably looking for some wealth from us. Maybe he's impressed by the possessions that we have, the gold that we've acquired. We're going to send him a gift, and that will be a worthy response to his invitation to submit to God and to him, and to follow him. So he says, وَإِنِّي مُرْسِلَةٌ إِلَيْهِمْ بِهَدِيَّةٍ فَنَاظِرَةٌ بِمَا يَرْجِعُ الْمُرْسَلُونَ. I'm going to send him a gift and see what happens. They go and they convey the gift to Nabi Sulaiman alayhi salam. Look at what he has to say to them. There's so much wisdom that the Quran has for us, brothers and sisters. فَلَمَّا جَاءَ سُلَيْمَانَ قَالَ أَتُمِدُّونَنِي بِمَالٍ. When the messenger comes to Sulaiman, he tells them, do you wish to assist me with your wealth? As if he's trying to tell him that, you think this was the reason behind why I invited you? He says, فَمَا آتَانِيَ اللَّهُ خَيْرٌ مِمَّا آتَاكُمْ. What Allah has given me is better than what He has given you. But rather, you are exultant and you are happy and you are just entertaining yourself with your gift and the nature of that type of thing. Now look at what sort of lessons we can get from this. These are some points that the great scholar of tafsir, who is Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, may Allah protect him, has told us about this particular tradition. He says the following. These are some of the points he has to offer. Look at the beauty. All right, number one, he says that when Nabi Sulaiman says that أَتُمِدُّونَنِي بِمَالِ, in Arabic, this is an expression of disdain, of saying that this thing that you bought for me, I have no regard for it. It's a joke, right? It says that it might be something which is plentiful in your eyes, but for me, it's nothing. I don't consider it to be anything. He says that from this verse, we can understand that Nabi Sulaiman is saying that you think you are very happy with the wealth that you have and that you have given us as a gift. But we don't get happy by these types of things. Another point, he says that if somebody were to give you a gift, Nabi Sulaiman is conveying, if somebody were to give you a gift of the same thing, then you would get busy and have frivolous entertainment with that. But we are not the same. He says the other thing, he says that when it comes to what we have, it's much better than what you have. Nabi Sulaiman didn't just have wealth at his disposal. He had a connection with Allah. This is something which was much more superior to whatever they had. He says, another thing that we gain from this is that the foundation by which they measured happiness was these type of things, physical and material wealth. But for Nabi Sulaiman alayhi salam, he had a higher standard which he upheld when it came to what is good and what is something which is worth getting happy about. The discussion is detailed. We don't want to go too much in depth, but the summary that we're gaining from this is that if you look at the perspective of Nabi Sulaiman alayhi salam, number one, he doesn't deny the role of wealth. He is one of the most wealthy, he's the most wealthy human being on earth, and he's making use of that wealth. But he's telling them that your perspective on life, where you only see things in the lenses of a materialist, is something which is wrong. It's something which is limited. Think beyond that. There's something else out there. When we go and look at this idea of materialism, brothers and sisters, right, and this is something that we seriously are plagued with, because after all, when you live amongst people who set their goals and align their goals in a certain way, then it's hard not to be influenced by that. It's something which is very natural. When we look at the nature of materialism, we see that it's actually something that doesn't fit with who we are as a human being. And I want to explain this by giving you an example. Imagine that you have your prized possession in front of you. Okay, just choose what it is. Maybe it's your iPad, your iPhone, your laptop, your car, whatever it is. Imagine this in front of you. Now ask yourself this simple question. How close is that thing to you? Right? You can go up to it and go very close to it. But for example, let's say it's my iPad right here. I can go up close to it, but essentially there will be one point of it which is close to me, one point which is far from me. If I turn it this way, then this point will be close to me and this point will be far from me. This other way, the same thing. No, I want the whole thing to be close to me. Well, I can't do that. I can't do it because essentially this is something which is different than me. Because at the end of the day, I myself am more than just my body. I'm not just a physical entity. Ask yourself this question, where are you? Is your I just here? Or is it just here? Or is it just there? No, your I is something which goes beyond the physical body. This body is part of you. This hand is part of you. This head is part of you. But you are something which goes beyond that. You yourself are part of a different world. You make use of this material world, but you're not part of it. That's example number one. Example number two. Imagine that you have a chance to go on a vacation next to the seaside. Now, you go and you know that it's going to come up. Okay, you're going to have a certain amount of time and you want to maximize the experience. So you go and find one of those cottages. It's not only next to the sea, it's actually on the sea itself. You know, they have these type of things. You take the dock and it's on the sea. Okay, fine. You're on the sea. You're sitting there, you're enjoying the vacation. But at the end of the day, do you have the sea? Do you have it? No, you don't have it. It's there, it's underneath you, but you still don't have it. And at the end of the day, you're going to be there for a few days, and after that, it's going to end. And the experience is just going to be a memory, and you're going to leave it behind. You did whatever you could to maximize the experience, but you hit a barrier, after which you have to leave it aside and say that, you know what? Now this is just going to be a memory in the past. I can't take you with me. These are examples which are, inshallah, intending to help us think about this. That when it comes to the material world, there's only so much that we can actually get from it. Imam Ali tells us in Nahjul Balagha, he says that look at the food that you eat. With so much difficulty, this food comes and enters into your body. And so many times we eat and then we might enjoy it to the maximum. But the more we enjoy it, it seems, the more consequences there are to come afterwards. There's no pure pleasure when it comes to the material world. Even we're drinking, let's say you're really thirsty. Right? This has happened to you. You're drinking water or you're drinking some liquid and you end up like just choking on it. Imam Ali talks about it as well. You choke on it. There's something about us when it comes to the material world, we can only go so far with it. Right? We go and we prepare this table spread with the most delightful looking cuisine. We spend hours preparing it. But can we take in that food in the form that it is? Even if we desire it so much, none of us can take it in the way it is. We have to take it in our mouth, chew it up into small, small little morsels, so that it looks like baby food, and only then can we actually take it in. So what was all that effort that we put forth? You see, brothers and sisters, we're not created to be people who consume this material world in its fullest sense. This is the way that Allah created the universe. Look at what Imam Ali alayhi salam tells us about ourselves. He says that lasna lid-dunya khuliqna. It wasn't for the world that we were created. Wa'alam annaka, he tells his son, wa'alam annaka innama khuliqta lil-akhirati la lid-dunya. You were created for another purpose. You were created for the hereafter, not for the dunya. Now imagine, brothers and sisters, that somebody makes it their goal in life purely to acquire possessions, to make it big. That's it. Not for another purpose. Now that situation, what's going to happen? They're looking for something that is impossible for them to attain. And what's going to end up happening is that they're going to feel like a loser. They're going to fail miserably. And that's why we see that despite having access to so many things that our forefathers didn't have, at the same time, the rate of depression has skyrocketed. People aren't happy. Even amongst us as well too. It's unnerving to understand what sort of issues people are facing on a psychological level, even within our own communities, despite having a lot going for them when it comes to the material world. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that we have to throw away our possessions and go live in huts. What I'm saying is that we have to have some criteria and some guidelines for how we interact with the material world. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. What are some of these guidelines that we are given by our respected scholars who have analyzed the Quran and Hadith and summarized for us some practical guidelines? Number one is that when it comes to knowing whether a possession is something which is good for us to have or not, I'm thinking whether I should buy this, should I buy or should I leave it? All right? So what do we do? How do we make that decision? Number one, they say that first of all, don't think that just because you have a desire for that thing, that somehow it's something which is wrong. Okay? That's not the criteria. I need a car, right? I'm only going to look for a car that I have no desire for. That's the one I'm going to drive. No. Right? Let's not try to be overly, like, you know, holier than what the Ahlul Bayt are asking us to be. No, that's not what it is. Okay? So that's not what we're looking for. The other thing is they say is that sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. They say that the criteria is that we need to not have attachment to our possessions. Okay, now what is the measure for whether we have attachment to our possession or not? Level one is the following. That on account of this possession that we have, or those steps that I'm taking to acquire this possession, for example, the career choices I make, the business deals I'm making, am I crossing the boundary of what's halal and haram? If it's the case that I've done that, I should know that this possession is something which was not something I should buy. So that's obviously going to be out of the picture. Okay, number two is that we have to see, and this is at a higher level, for those who are able to at least get to this point where with the possessions that they have, with the career choices they make, they're not doing halal, they're not crossing the boundary of what's haram. Number two is the following. This is, again, this is sort of like the advanced level, which is the following, that do I really need this thing? Because if I'm in need of it, then even if I like it, then I should be sure that it's something which is good for me. I can go ahead and buy it. But if it's the case that I don't need it, I'm still buying it, then I have to ask the question why, because this can lead me into a lot of problems. One of them being something called tafakhur, where I'm buying this just to keep up with my neighbor, with the other people. Or I'm taking this step, I'm spending my money in a certain way. Sometimes you hear about people sending their kids to certain schools at a very young age. Right? At an age where they're supposed to be playing, they're supposed to be enjoying themselves. And you ask them why they're doing it, they say that if I don't do it, they're going to be left behind, and everyone else is doing it as well too. Is this a valid criterion for why we should spend our money? Isn't this attaching ourselves to the dunya in a way which is going to harm us in the future? These are some simple guidelines. And when it comes to choices, when it comes to the workplace, should I take on this extra work or not? I'm just giving some guidelines, inshallah. These are things that need to be thought about, worked on, discussed. This isn't a place for having a workshop on the topic. Just some basic guidelines. I have an option of taking on more work. Is this going to be working for the dunya, or is it something that is valid for me to do? Simple question, that if you take on this extra work, are you going to be able to still fulfill your duties towards God and to others that Allah has appointed for you? If it's the case that you can manage that, you still have the balance, then bismillah, if you want to go and work those extra hours, make that extra money, use it for good purposes, then that's fine. But if it's the case that taking on this extra work is going to cause one to neglect their responsibilities towards their children, towards their home, towards their community, then in that case, it needs to be left aside, even if it's a wonderful opportunity. I want to make it clear, brothers and sisters, that Islam is not calling us to leave aside the pursuit of money. No. The pursuit of the dunya can be, if it's done for the hereafter, for noble purposes, it's not counted as something which is lowly. It's counted as something which is actually a very lofty thing. Because we're trying to be practical, I just want to end this discussion by giving you a couple of examples that I've encountered recently in my experiences. Of people who I feel are very noble in what they did with their wealth. For example, I met somebody who said that, you know what, I've started a company. And one of my goals in starting the company is so that I can hire those muhajjaba women who come from, who migrate into the country and who would otherwise find it very difficult to find jobs. But this is what I'm doing. And when I heard that from him, I was like, may Allah bless you. You know, barakallahu fi. Okay. Another example. Somebody finds out that their near relatives are in severe need of their time and their money. They completely reschedule their career plans in order to still get whatever they need in order to keep their family alive. But now they spend all their time and all their extra money in supporting their near relatives. Another example. Somebody finds out that there is an initiative, this is a real example, initiative to create an Islamic school, a real Islamic school. And this person was a big businessman. But what he did is he took the bulk of his future wealth that would have made him into like the Forbes list of the top 100, whatever, right? And he puts it into the school. He says, I'm going to put my own fortune and make it, put it on stake. That's how much I believe in this idea of the school. Or another person who says that, you know what, I could go on and pursue my career right now, but I have an opportunity to take some time away and to go to the Hawza and to pursue some religious studies so that I can fulfill an eminent need in the community where we're facing a situation where we don't have enough qualified scholars. These are just some examples of how somebody, people that I've met have interacted with the dunya and not fallen into the trap. Now, in conclusion, brothers and sisters, the point that we're trying to make here, Imam al-Islam is warning us, this is one interpretation, he's warning us that when you go to Dar al-Shirk, be aware that you don't become gharib. Let not yourself become lonely when you're among that land and you're in that land of shirk. One of the ways that can happen is by being attached to the material world. Because the material world isn't going to fulfill our needs. What is it that is going to fulfill our needs? How can we be happy here? How can we not feel that loneliness? The answer comes to us in another tradition. And this is from the story of Nabi Yusuf a.s. This is from hadith. They say that when Yusuf was taken out of the well and bought as a slave, someone said to those who purchased him, they said, take good care of this gharib. After all, he's been taken away from his homeland. He's a gharib. He's someone who's alone. Take good care of him. What does Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam say in response to that? He says, فَقَالَ لَهُمْ يُوسُفْ مَنْ كَانَ مَعَ اللَّهِ فَلَيْسَ لَهُ غُرْبَةً. The one who is with Allah will never face loneliness. In response to that feeling that some people sometimes have of being in a society and feeling like they're nothing, feeling like they have nothing, and sometimes it even gets to the point where they feel like their life is worthless and maybe they can just give it up. The answer to that is that, no, we have something which is our relationship with Allah, and we need to and we must work on that, particularly when we're in this society. We only got a chance to go through one of the interpretations, inshallah, if Allah gives us tawfiq. Tomorrow we'll continue this and discuss the other interpretation of this hadith, which is also very important, very necessary. I pray that Allah accepts these efforts, that He helps us to understand the nature of the society we're living in and to show us a way of navigation through the society in a way that we can please Him the most. Before I begin the masail portion, I just wanted to thank those mu'mineen who have been the brave soldiers to come and introduce themselves and give me their names and talk to me after the programs. I really appreciate that. Just tonight, we have a special meeting with some very precious people who are listening to this program, but in a different location of this complex, and so I won't be able to join you after the program tonight, but inshallah from tomorrow night we'll continue being available for those who would like to, inshallah, discuss and meet. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. When we go back in history, brothers and sisters, and we look at what were some of the outstanding characteristics of the ladies and the children of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, one of them that stands out to us is that despite being people who had faced so many difficulties leading up to the day of Ashura and following that, they had seen their own menfolk killed in front of their eyes. They had seen their tents looted and burned right in front of them. They had seen their children being orphaned. They had seen the bodies of their menfolk laid out in the sand, unburied without any coffins. But yet, we don't see a single report in history of even one of these ladies or one of these children complaining over what took place on Sham-e Ghariban or the day afterwards. They accepted with all patience and with all dignity what took place to them. And this was the case, if we examine history, until a certain point when they entered the city of Kufa. Let's go and examine that incident. Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Sallallahu alayka wa ala ukhtika Zainab وبنتك سكينة When the ladies of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam are entering the city of Kufa, we see that one of them by the name of Umm Kulthum, the daughter of Ali and Fatima, can no longer bear it. The city has been prepared for a festivity. The stores and the stalls have been abandoned. All have gathered to see who are the prisoners that are coming to town. Among them are men who are staring, trying to see who is among the prisoners. Umm Kulthum cries out, Ya Ahla Kufa, Ghaddu Absarakum Anna. O people of Kufa, cover your eyes, turn them away from us. Amma tastahyuna min Allahi wa Rasulah. Have you no shame in front of Allah and His Messenger? أن تنظروا إلى حرم رسول الله. That you should be gazing upon the haram of the Messenger of Allah. One of the ladies of the people of Kufa is looking at them. She doesn't recognize them. She cries out to them, Man ayyul asara antunna? Can you introduce yourselves to me? Umm Kulthum replies, she says, Nahnu usara ali Muhammadin sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. Look at the ignorance of the people, they don't even know who the family of the Prophet is. According to history, when the Ahlul Bayt see what's happening, Umm Kulthum is so upset by the situation, she composes the following poetry. She says to the people of Kufa, مَاذَا تَقُولُونَ إِذَا قَالَ النَّبِيُّ لَكُمْ مَاذَا تَقُولُونَ إِذْ قَالَ النَّبِيُّ لَكُمْ ماذا فعلتم وأنتم وآخر الأمم. What are you going to say when the Prophet comes to you and questions you?
what you've done despite being the last of the ummas. بِعِتْرَتِي وَبِأَهْلِي بَعْدَ مُفْتَقِدِي. What did you do to my family and my progeny after I died? مِنْهُمْ أُسَارَ وَمِنْهُمْ ضُرْجُوا بِدَمِي. Among them are those who you've imprisoned, and among them are those you have spattered with their blood. مَنْ مَا كَانَ هَذَا جَزَائِي إِذْ نَصَحْتُ لَكُمْ. Is this what I asked you for when I preached to you? أَنْ تُخْلِفُونِ بِسُوءٍ فِي ذَوِي رَحِمِي. That you should treat my family in such an evil way. إِنَّنِي لَأَخْشَى عَلَيْكُمْ أَنْ يَحِلَّ بِكُمْ مِثْلُ الْعَذَابِ الَّذِي يَأْتِي عَلَى الْأُمَمِ. I fear for you that the same punishment that befell other nations will now befall you. ألا لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون. مات من حسين.